festival features more than 100 performances on 4 stages, including the Robert Cray Band, St. Paul and the Broken Bones, Trombone Shorty, and Vintage Trouble. There will also be workshops, cruises on the Willamette River, activities for kids, after-hour jams, fireworks, and more. Again, that's the 32nd Annual Waterfront Blues Festival, July 4th through 7th at Waterfront Park in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring a morning news and public affairs director as well as an evening news and public affairs director to manage the news and public affairs programming. For these two full-time positions, we're looking for people with proven experience in audio production, management, and supervisory skills with volunteers with an emphasis on teamwork in a collaborative setting, and the ability to work under strict deadlines. KBOO Community Radio is an equal opportunity and affirmative action employer. Women and people of color are encouraged to apply. The deadline to apply for both of these positions is Monday, July 1st at midnight. More information can be found at kboo.fm/employment.
Hello, hello, and how's it going? My name is Tammy, and you are listening to Popular Education, or also known as Pop Ed, I think, that has a nicer tone to it. This evening, I'm joined in the studio with Mike. How's it going, Mike?
Hello, hello. It's going well, thank you. I'm happy to be here.
It's a pleasure, as always. So part of this, I'm going to be doing like a different format for the program, and it's going to be kind of like a today in history kind of thing. So I'm going to be sharing historical facts, ideas, events, births, and even deaths that happened on the day. With that being said, in research for tonight's episode, I found out that June 20th is World Refugee Day. It was named by the UN in 2000, and World Refugees aim to bring attention to the struggles and misconceptions of refugees who are displaced by war and prosecution. This year, activists are using the hashtag #StepWithRefugees as a way to raise awareness to the struggles refugees endure when finding safe haven. So without further ado, I'm going to get into it. I'd also like to thank Rose City Native Radio for their great music and the great work that they do. So the first part of tonight's episode, I'm going to start off with a short clip from MSN. Here we have a reporter that's speaking with Denise Bell of Amnesty International about her research and work with refugees.
In 2000, the theme this year is #StepWithRefugees, a message to make steps in solidarity with refugees who trek more than 1 billion miles each year to reach the nearest point of safety. So I want to bring in Denise Bell, a researcher for refugee and migrant rights from Amnesty International. Denise, when you look at the stats, what is something that stands out or surprises you the most when it comes to the life that refugees have to live?
What strikes me the most is that these people are people just like you and me, people who are in search of safety, who have been forced to flee their homes. Half of them are children. I met these children recently in Lebanon and Jordan, and their parents and their children, all they want is a better life, safety, security, dignity.
Yeah, what are some of those stats? I saw one earlier that said 37,000 people are displaced every day. That's a lot of people who are having their lives changed forever.
Exactly, and they're fleeing because they can't stay where they are because of war, because of persecution, human rights abuses. Nobody wants to leave their home, and they have to because they'll be killed.
Yeah. I think it's important that you say they're people like all of us, because these situations could happen to any of us if we're living in a different place.
Exactly.
So you released a report this week about families that are still in limbo, yes?
Yes, absolutely.
What's that about?
Well, the report is the mountain is in front of us and the sea is behind us, which Fatima, a refugee I met in a refugee camp in Jordan, that was her quote to explain this impossible limbo that they find themselves in. The U.S. government promised these families that they could come to the United States 2.5 years ago. One family was given a new home in Richmond, Virginia, and then President Trump signed the first Muslim ban, and this refugee family was told that they were banned. Mm. And they said to me, "We don't understand. We cleared all the checks. We were told our new home. We gave away everything. And it's 2.5 years later, and we're still here, and they can't stay where they are. They can't go home. And they don't know what to do. We broke our promise."
Yeah, yeah. So the report, who is intended to see it? Who do you want to read it?
I want the American public to read it. I want them to know what the government is doing in their name, how we made promises to tens of thousands of refugees to give them new homes, and we've broken those promises.
What do you think is the most common misconception about refugees in this country?
That they're somebody else, that they're not like us. Mm-hmm. But let me tell you, they're exactly like us. I've met dozens of refugees who stayed at home until they could no longer live there because the bombs kept falling. And then they moved to the nearby town, in a nearby town. And then they realized for their children's safety, they had to leave for a new place.
Yeah, and so before we go, I just want you to maybe offer us some of the big or small steps, like this hashtag is saying, that people can take in solidarity.
Well, one step they can take in solidarity is to be part of this worldwide movement to welcome refugees. We know that millions of Americans across this country want to welcome refugees as friends, as neighbors. And one way you can do that is go to amnestyusa.org. We have a series of very easy actions to take so members of Congress can help get these families here like we promised.
All right, Denise Bell from Amnesty International, I appreciate you joining us today.
Thank you, it's been a pleasure.
The UN published today that in 2018 there were 71 million refugees in the world, which is the highest in 70 years. In part of this clip, Denise Bell mentioned that the report also included families who are in limbos. This shows how much red tape and bureaucracy is involved when a family or individual are trying to flee their homes, which become unsafe because, you know, honestly, 9 times out of 10, political unrest caused by governments and paramilitary groups are the ones responsible, not civilians. So with that being said, I'd like to play part of an interview I had a little while ago with Mohamed Al-Ajiri. Mohamed is a healthcare professional at OSHU. He manages two of their primary healthcare facilities. I was introduced to Mohamed when I was covering the development of the Yemen humanitarian crisis. At the time of the interview, Bernie Sanders had just endorsed the bill calling for the U.S. to halt all fueling of Saudi planes whose mission was to target Houthi rebels inside of Yemen. Mohamed's family has been displaced from the war, and some are still stuck in Yemen, while others are displaced in the U.S., Europe, and other places where refugees often find themselves in limbo. I'd like to go ahead and thank Mohamed so much for allowing me to interview him. And without further ado, here we go.
My name is Mohamed Al-Ajiri. I am a resident of the Portland area. I moved to Portland 5 years ago from Corvallis. I grew up most of my life in Corvallis, Oregon. My wife and I live here in Hillsboro, and we have 3 boys that are going to school here as well, young boys. We are both, I work for OHSU, Oregon Health and Science University. I manage 2 of their primary care clinics out in Hillsboro and Beaverton. And my wife works for Nike. And we are happy to be here in the Portland area, of course, with quite a different environment than being in Corvallis, Oregon.
Yeah. Oh, so you're really doing the Portland thing with Nike and the university.
The quintessential Portland experience.
It's fantastic. And how long you said you've been in Portland?
5 years. We moved out here October in 2013. And we both grew up in Corvallis. My wife and I both moved to Corvallis in the early 90s, her with her family and I with mine.
So can you tell us a little bit more about growing up in Corvallis with your family?
Yeah. So my family originally moved from Yemen when I was 10 years old in the early 90s. My dad was getting his PhD at Oregon State University, and I was immediately immersed into the school system and made friends and helped my family navigate through the different systems because I picked up a language fairly quickly. And so I would often be the translator for my mom at our appointments and helping her with school stuff for my siblings. And, you know, within the year, I felt pretty integrated with the community and friends in school and all that. And started middle school after that. And then high school, my family, it was time for my family to move back to Yemen. That's where I came from. And my dad finished his PhD. So in the middle of my junior year of high school, so I decided to stay and finishing out the year with some really close family friends who offered to take me in. Once I finished high school, I decided to stay and apply for college and universities, and I did that, and I got accepted to Oregon State University and ended up going to getting my bachelor's degree and then eventually my master's degree. And in, you know, in between all that, got married, met my wife. I met my wife actually before that, but we got married in college. Aww. And decided to just keep raise our families here in Oregon. So.
Yeah, it's a beautiful place. I can't
believe it. Yeah, the Pacific Northwest is beautiful. Oregon is a beautiful state, and I don't see myself really living in other states in the foreseeable future. But, you know, for now it's home, second home. Obviously, my extended family is all in Yemen. So I definitely feel my roots in Yemen, but at the same time, being in Oregon for most of my life, it's definitely home.
And you mentioned that your father was doing a PhD here. Could you get a little bit more to that? It was a UN program.
Yeah, we were here on a UN food program scholarship. He was doing his research in the hazelnut. Oregon was at the time pretty prominent in the hazelnut research, which would help the crops in the agricultural scene in Yemen. So we came on that visa, obviously, and that scholarship. So
that's fun. And what year was that? Was in the
this
90s.
Was in 1990.
That's fantastic. Yeah. So it was just kind of like a learning, both countries coming together,
learning
from each other.
Yeah, there was a lot of work at the time as it relates to agriculture. OSU was known for its agricultural degrees and programs and research, and so OSU actually brought many Yemeni families from Yemen under the same program, UN program. So when we came to Corvallis, Oregon, there were about 20 families, students and families. After the first Gulf War, those scholarships actually stopped. And so we haven't seen that many Yemeni immigrants or students come to the state until recently with the war and people actually coming here for different reasons. So, yeah, unfortunately, but
interesting. That's so beautiful to be able to bring different nationalities just for the most human thing, which is nature and working with the land. And
absolutely, it was the various people that we met when we first moved here were Corvallis was a very multicultural city. It was Oregon State University, obviously. So we met folks from all over the Middle East, Europe, Southeast Asia, and so it was just a beautiful place to be. OSU brought all these families together. And, you know, some of those people became my closest friends up until now, just for the shared experience of their parents coming here for the same reasons. It's definitely, Oregon has been, has a special place in my heart for all those reasons. Obviously, not just because I live here, but also what it was doing for my family, my friends' families, Yemen.
And also what your family did for, you know, for the city, for the state, being able to share your father being able to share his knowledge when helping too.
Taking it back to Yemen and disseminating some of that good information to help Yemen and its agricultural needs.
So I guess fast forwarding to now, your father, is he still doing stuff?
He's retired. He's in Yemen. And unfortunately, because of the recent conflicts and war in the over the past 3 to 4 years, many government employees, officials, researchers have really haven't been very productive. He retired early just because he was finishing basically his research and didn't want to do anything new. But others are now sort of just stuck in this limbo situation. And we're trying to figure out a way for him to come visit us or come be with us right now. As I mentioned to you, my family since the war has been displaced voluntarily and involuntarily. So I tried to help them leave the situation and to come here, but it's difficult and challenging to bring family members here. Even though I'm here, I'm a U.S. citizen. My mom is here actually now finally. But so I have siblings that are still overseas, and including our dad who's in Yemen with one of my younger siblings.
And you mentioned that there's difficulties bringing your family members to be with you at in a safe country.
Sure.
What are the issues you're seeing?
In general, it's been difficult to bring family members to the U.S. There's a process, obviously. There's a legal process of you apply for them through the legal channels, and the immigration process is lengthy. It's easier for when somebody, you know, gets married and bring their spouse here, it's easier to bring your mother or father. Mm-hmm. But with siblings who are over the age of 18, it takes many, many years. So before this conflict even started, I had really applied for all of them to come here. And I applied in 2007. And they're still sort of in line or on the list to be processed.
So it's not a matter of a couple of months. It's
no,
years,
it's
and
years,
years
and years and years. Fortunately for my mother, it was quick. It was a year. And so she was able to come here and able to come visit me and my family once or twice a year. My siblings, not so much. But then with the war and the conflict that ensued in 2015, we were able to try a different path, which is the refugee path. So that wasn't our intention. Our intention to get them out initially was because of the heated bombing campaign at the time. Mm-hmm. We didn't know the situation. And so we figured if we have the means to get them out temporarily for a month or two until things calm down, we would do that and then they can come back. Well, 2-3 months turned into 2-3 years and now we're in our fourth year. So when I first helped them get out of the country, they ended up in Malaysia, by the way, because Malaysia at the time was taking Yemeni refugees, you know, displaced from the war. I went there and tried to register them all with the UNHCR Office for Refugees. So
in Malaysia.
In Malaysia.
Mm-hmm.
And also the U.S. Embassy there to help my youngest brother actually expedite his process that I applied for many years ago. So I was fortunate to have his process expedited, so he was able to come here because he was under 18. And the other ones who were over 18, we weren't so lucky, so we just have them signed up as temporary refugees in Malaysia. That process is also lengthy. It was lengthy in the past. It is more so now with the current administration, obviously. Most people know the travel bans. That's another layer of complexity because even visiting, which they were able to come and visit in the past, are now no longer able to come visit.
Can't come visit they in the States because of the
with
travel
a legal
ban.
Visitor visa is no longer given to Yemeni residents, unfortunately. So all these compounding factors to make uniting us has been difficult and challenging, to say the least. So.
And how long has it been since you've seen all of your family?
The whole family hasn't really been together since 2007. I've seen my siblings here and there with these different visits. So in Malaysia, I saw most of them that were in Yemen. And the ones that live in the U.S. I see, obviously, pretty often just because they're here. But my second youngest sibling I haven't seen since 2010. We actually rendezvoused in France. I happened to be there for my graduate work, and he was there visiting. He's a flight attendant, so he just happened to be there. So we met there. That was the last time I saw him. Our dad I haven't seen since 2007.
And do you talk to them? Do you have any
kinds
of communications?
We are in constant communication on a daily basis, I would say, through various means.
Mm-hmm.
The WhatsApp is definitely the easiest way to communicate with people. The phone, obviously, the internet, Facebook, social media. So that's happening. It's just we're trying to figure out plans for the future. Do we continue at this date for the foreseeable future? Or do we plan for some kind of planning for rendezvous somewhere. I know I'm working with our senator's offices to help expedite the process with some of the foundations here that are helping refugees process their work. We're trying the immigration route as well, of course, with lawyers. So we're trying everything we can to figure out the opportunities for them to come here.
Yeah. And this is, you know, one family. You can just imagine the millions of people.
Absolutely. I think I was telling you earlier that I feel fortunate that we even have these opportunities to do this. I mean, millions and millions don't have any means of hope for leaving the country or even coming to a safe area to just be away from the conflict. And those who have been displaced in different countries really are on the same boat as my family is, waiting for the process to work itself.
Bureaucracy.
And of course, again, with the new administration, that created even more challenge just because they reduced the number of refugees allowed. And adding the travel ban, which focuses on people from those countries, including Yemen, made it even near impossible to come here.
And so when you do speak with family members that are still in Yemen, what are their opinions? What are they seeing? What is their day-to-day lives like?
Yeah, I mean, initially it was just fear and being away from the bombings and also being away from the militias on the ground. So it was just multiple factors that kept them in constant state of fear. They didn't really know where things are headed, who to trust, who not to trust. And then, of course, they left. And I still have extended family in Yemen. So my immediate family are the ones that mainly left. The cousins, uncles, aunts are all still there. And so the day-to-day is those who can still go to work and come back. Those who have no work because of the government is basically shut down, remain at home and just sort of wait it out. Sometimes there is a sense of normalcy from what I hear from them on a day-to-day, but and other times it becomes a heightened state of fear and concern, so they remain at home. Relatives who are in other cities like Taiz are facing the most difficulties because the Houthis are mainly occupied that area. The capital wasn't so bad only because this is where the current Houthi government is and they're trying to maintain balance just because it's in their favor to make sure there's no chaos. So it depends. I mean, it just depends where people are and how they're feeling. I think majority of the issues are around the outside of the main cities, with the exception of Taiz, where it had a really bad stint with the Houthi militia attacks. Again, politically, no one really wants to take a side in Yemen just because it's so sensitive and you never know who will gain power. And so you sort of just stay in your lane and be neutral and not really get involved just because it's that dangerous over there right now. Yemenis outside of Yemen are more free to voice their opinion, even though really it's not recommended just because it can impact them back in Yemen. But yeah, it's a state of limbo. I mean, there isn't really nothing much happening diplomatically. The international community is trying. There's some talks here and there, but really nothing materialized to anything meaningful. The airports are still shuttered. Government salaries aren't being dispensed in a timely manner, and schools are on and off. Worse so for areas away from the main cities, like I said earlier, in the rural areas, it's just devastating. Famine is just rampant and cholera. In the main cities, it hasn't reached that level yet, but it's the lack of resources is starting to be felt, whether it's gas or food or even just being able to send family money is sometimes impacted by the situation.
So as a professional, what are your opinions about the famine that's happening there, the humanitarian crisis? What do you think?
Yeah, the humanitarian effort has definitely been the most impactful for all of us outside just because we don't really have any say in the political discussions. We don't really have any input on how to fix the situation. There's no solution in sight as far as it's a power vacuum. So everyone directs their efforts on the humanitarian effort, whether it's international community or the local organizations or even Yemenis abroad. So, and that has been impacted for various reasons, whether it's the shortage of food and humanitarian aid or the blockades at the different ports by various parties with ulterior motives, whether it's the Houthis or the coalition. The end goal is still the same. People aren't getting what they need in timely manner. So people are dying of hunger, cholera spreading, the water supplies are sort of, you know, decreasing as well. Yeah, and so it's more impactful to me personally, or more, it resonates more with me personally because it's my background and I know some of these things we've studied and we've learned about and we've researched on for other countries. So it's much more difficult when it hits close to home, when it hits home, in fact. And so, like I said, in the main cities, it hasn't gotten to that point except for that the hospitals aren't being serviced as much as they should be, obviously, with all the casualties and the sickness. People are dying from lack of medication or diabetics or people with kidney disease. The people in the rural and born poor areas are dying from not having the basic necessities to live. And you've seen all the images on TV and the news about starving children. But it's you know, everyone's to blame for that. It's not any one side. It's the entire situation is to be blamed, obviously. And the international community is trying its best, but I also feel like there's not enough pressure being put on all the sides that are involved in this to kind of come to a conclusion about either a peace process or a ceasefire or a humanitarian delivery sort of method for us to get things through, that the fear of it being looted or taken or not even reaching its destination. So it's really challenging. And for Yemenis like myself who are abroad or here, not abroad, but out of Yemen, we're trying our best to find ways to help people, whether it's working with NGOs on the ground or working with any nonprofit here who's trying to help. And you know, I mentioned to you earlier that we had a shipment of 300 metric tons of wheat going from Oregon to Yemen. This is in September. That was really, that was such a heartwarming experience to be part of that, to witness that. And that much wheat only reached so many people. It was only enough for 3 months for about 7 million people. So can't imagine how much effort is needed to get everyone what they need. This country of 28 million people. Who are in need of all these supplies.
Since this interview took place, international efforts led by politicians and civilian activists have made some efforts. We heard some of the issues from Hamid that people face that are some of the issues that people face that cause them to seek refuge or asylum in a different country. So, for example, in Britain, just some of the efforts that are taking place. In Britain, activists from the Campaign Against Arms Trade, or CAAT, C-A-A-T, lobbied the UK courts of appeals to stop arms deals to Saudi forces. This is pretty big because since the military intervention in 2015, the UK has licensed at least £4.6 billion or $6 billion worth of arms to Saudi forces. That's 43% of London's arms export. Al Jazeera reported earlier today that the new appeal was passed and declared British arms sales to Saudi Arabia for use against a war in Yemen unlawful. But, you know, with, like everything, the devil's in the details, and the court ruling doesn't necessarily mean the end to future sales, but it does put them in jeopardy. The Court of Appeals says ministers have legal obligations to assess the allegations of serious human rights violation before allowing any kinds of arms sales, but in the case of the Saudi Arabia war in Yemen, the court stated that the government, that's the British government, didn't make, quote-unquote, the attempt to do so, end quote. So the UK is forced to change the way that they assess the risk of international humanitarian law before approving exports. So pretty much they have to reevaluate the way that they reevaluate. So the court's decision does not immediately suspend existing licenses, and it does not affect any existing stocks or support or maintenance even provided to the Saudi Air Forces. And the Prime Minister, Theresa May, says that the government will appeal against a ruling. But in the same token, earlier this year, British ministers provided about £2 million, that's $250 million to Yemen, to help feed about close to 4 million people. That brings the total humanitarian support to the war to £770 million. That's almost $980 million. Aid organizations in London, the Oxfam specifically, said that this is, end quote, incoherent policy, means that it gives with one hand and take with the other, end quote. So pretty much that's where we stand with Yemen right now. That's the update. And Mike, you got anything to say? You seem pretty blown away by the stats.
Numbers always confuse me because numbers are one of those things that is easily manipulated.
Yes.
And it's interesting that the closing words was they feed them with one hand and then they take it away with the other, and it's just that it's more of a policy where unless it makes money to help, it's not worth helping.
Yeah, so it's a pretty, I mean, my personal opinion that it is a pretty big deal that a country that or I guess a company that create so much revenue off of war is being told to stop by a government sustained by, you know, civilian activists that are saying, hey, no, this is not going to happen. So, you know, the idea of fleeing a land because of prosecution didn't start in 2015 or even, you know, in the with the Mexican border crisis that we're seeing, or even World War II. Across cultures, we've been told tales, fables, and stories about people migrating or finding refuge after things like exile or some sort of oppression. From the story of the Israelites to other nations in biblical times to ancient Greeks and Egyptians, civil wars, genocide, rebels, and even kings, the stories of exile and asylum seekers is not new to us. And in the interview with Mohammed, he mentioned that he reached out to Human Rights Services, the UN, and the UNHCR. And so I wanted to spend the rest of the time focusing on the origins of those organizations and the role that they had in helping refugees, and how the U.S. has reacted to refugees in the past as well as now. So, yeah, we are going to start with just a little side fact that it wasn't until the 18th century that nationalism was kind of on the rise. That's when a European adopted the concept of country of nationality, which required a person to show ID when crossing a border. So the whole idea of, like, I don't want to say politicizing, but putting the red tape by a border isn't something that we've always done. What we have always done is try to migrate, try to find freedom, try to find a place where we feel safe. So that's just something I want to mention there.
It's human nature that transcends time, mm-hmm. that you look for refuge. Mm-hmm. And when you're experiencing so much trauma and war, and with war you have constant devastation and depletion of resources and people. Mm-hmm. It's human nature to seek refuge. Mm-hmm. It's human nature to seek safety. And as humans, you expect that countries that have an excess amount of resources and they can provide security and policing the rest of the world, that they can help these refugees,
yeah.
Looking for asylum and looking for help and looking for that safety.
Yeah. And in that token, the first modern definition of an international refugee came from the League of Nations, so that's like in the 20s. The commission was charged with assisting about 1 million people who fled the Russian Revolution in 1917 and, you know, the civil war that ensued afterwards. And then later in 1923, the mandate of the commission was expanded. So it also was targeting or, you know, trying to help Armenians who fled Turkish Asia in 1915. And the series of events that took place afterwards, which we now call the Armenian Genocide. So the League of Nations was eventually dismantled, and then in World War II, around 1915, in response to a large number of people that were fleeing Eastern Europe, you know, like you're mentioning, when there is a nation that can help, the UN was tasked with that mission to create a whole agency, or like a refugee agency, and that was the inception of the UNHCR, the United, or also known as the UN High Commission for Refugee. It's a UN program which is mandated to protect refugees who have been forcibly displaced in communities that where the people are stateless. It helps them with voluntarily relocation and integration and resettlement through a third country. It's also important to mention that earlier in that year, right before that, in 1949, the UNRWA was established by the UN General Assembly. This was specifically to carry out direct relief that works for Palestinian refugees following the 1948 Arab-Israeli War. The agency began operation in May of 1950, and essentially right now there are two UN coalitions kind of geared towards aid refugee. One is for specifically Palestinian refugees and one for the rest of the world. And personally, Mike, I think that speaks volume about, you know, the type of situation and what's happening in the world.
And the lack of assistance for people who are seeking help,
yeah,
and safety, that there's only two.
Yeah. And it embodies so much. And you can definitely see with, like in the end of World War II, Europe had 40 million refugees. And I think that the stats today for Palestinian refugees stands at 5 million, and that's just in one small place. So just back to the timeline, we are going to go back to the actual definition of the UN of what is a refugee, and that is someone who is owning a well-founded fear of being prosecuted for reasons of race, religion, nationality, membership, or membership of a particular social or political opinion. The definition was later expanded in 67 to include external aggression, occupation, foreign denomination, or events seriously disturbing the public order in the person's origin or nationality, and they are compelled to leave the place of habitat in order to seek refuge in an outside place. And that was also adopted by the Organization of African Unity in 69. So later on, you know, tracking to 2011, the official stand of what a refugee is by the UN is also someone who is outside of their country or nationality of residence and is unable to return their owing or serious discrimination, threats of life, physical integrity, or freedom resulting from generalized violence or events seriously disturbing public order, which is definitely a lot more broad than the original 51 document. And, you know, all these policies, you know, we were talking before, it's just a reflection of what's happening at the time.
Yeah, it's a culture change, mm-hmm. and it's in being more informed. And a lot of the organizations, our time, it's speaking out. It's speaking volumes that people are no longer okay with mm-hmm. the way the status quo.
Yeah, they're changing it. Yeah, that's definitely.
And I mean, I think it's fair to believe that everyone's situation is different,
mm-hmm.
and everyone should be treated differently according to mm-hmm. their individual situation. So who is the ones to do that? Who are the ones to make sure that, you know, each person is treated in their way,
yeah,
according to their situation?
Yeah. And in that, with the so there's also mentioned the other refugee agency, so the UNRWA on their website says that the services are available, and under their definition of what a Palestinian refugee is a service are available for all those living in its area of operation, those who meet this definition, who are registered with the agency and need assistance. The descendants of Palestinian refugee males, including adopted children, who are also eligible for registration. So, so the actual definition is persons who normal place of residence in Palestine during the period of 1947 to 1948, and those who both home and means of livelihood as a result of the 1948 conflict was ruined. So, like you said, they're, you know, very specific to the times and to the people that are, you know, suffer the brunt of it all. So coming to the U.S., because I want to just kind of bring it back here, kind of went super international and everywhere. The U.S. in the beginning, in like the 1800s, was pretty lenient with immigration and even their definition of what a refugee is. It wasn't until like, 1891 that Congress created the Bureau of Immigration to oversee the admissions of immigrants, including those considered quote unquote refugees. In the early days, the U.S. immigration law did not restrict the number of immigration that the U.S. would accept, and so no separate laws existed for refugees. And so the refugees could settle in the U.S. as long as they met the regular requirements of any immigrant admissions, you know? Just were good citizens, good people, and just did what they need to do.
The basic requirement.
The basic requirement of a decent citizen. Of a citizen, decent human being, yeah.
I mean, what more can you ask mm-hmm. for? That would be the requirement of anyone.
Yeah.
But, yeah, they had to point that out specifically.
Yeah, and later on, so, you know, and you also have to think, like we mentioned, it's a time. So in the 20s, that's when they had it's very similar to what is kind of happening now. They had the Emergency Quota Act and the a new Immigration Act in 1924. So, you know, it's very similar to what kind of is happening now. And so altogether, they're called the Quota Acts, and they were very specific quotas on how many immigrants could enter the U.S. every year. And it kind of made it easier for Northern and Western Europeans, but way harder for immigrants from the rest of Europe. So specifically Jewish people and minorities. And you got to think a lot of people sought refuge in the U.S. from prosecution overseas before and during World War II, you know, and the Holocaust. So, you know, it's...
That's interesting that restriction was placed
yeah.
during the time
yeah.
of that particular war.
But then also those times where the, you know, the Roaring Twenties, and, you know, it's
high expenses,
yeah.
a lot of spending,
yeah.
Excessive.
So it's like I think the way that a nation treats immigration is very telling of just their culture of the time. Because then later in the 40s, President Truman authorized that any displaced person and refugees should receive expedited admissions into the U.S. within the frameworks of existing immigration law. Additionally, the president's directive allowed approximately 1,000 refugees already in the U.S. to adjust to a lawful resident status. So, you know, you get a new president, and you get a different mindset and a new approach towards immigration, and you see how it can eventually help the nation, because you saw all the immigrants and with Ellis Island and everything, how much everyone brought with them, and it still resonates with American culture now.
Throughout history, you can see how the country was shaped and how it evolved with different cultures affecting it in mm-hmm. different ways. And because of these policies that allowed certain refugees mm-hmm. and disallowed others, you can see where those refugees were excelling and doing well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Not to say that during those times it was a, you know, good time for everyone to be in the States. You know, there's still struggles that the nation was facing. And so, you know, during the 40s, more and more Jews and Europeans came to America, and, you know, like you mentioned, and now shaping and every type of immigrant and every large migration and large refugee, you know, influx of refugees is going to resonate with the culture and just make it better and better and better. So fast forwarding, about 10 years later, the U.S., so we're talking, people trying to escape communist countries, right? So the U.S. in 1953 up to 1956 was issuing visas to Chinese refugees, about 2,000, and over 6,000 Hungarian refugees. So at that time, you know, we're talking about quotas. The immigration quota for Chinese refugees was at 105. So that is more than three times, 200 times? I don't know what math. It's a lot more than the quota that was proposed. And then the U.S. authorized nearly 200,000 special non-quota immigrant visas for refugees and escapees from communist countries. So again, very telling and showing of the time. And then we roll to the 80s. And this right here is really where I want to get your opinion about the time, because 80s was a crazy time.
Certainly.
It was a crazy time. And you're in New York at the time, and it was such a melting pot. I want to focus on, all right, let's just start. I'm getting all excited. In the midst of all the influx of refugees coming from Vietnam and Cambodia after the Vietnam War, there were new acts that were sustained, and the U.S. officially adopted the UN's definition for a refugee. But then in April 20th of 1980, the Castro regime announced that all Cubans wishing to go to the U.S. were free to board a boat to America. You just leave. Go ahead. And then about thousands of Cubans entered the U.S. Many traveled to Florida on boats organized by grassroots American supporters. And then...
Yeah.
That's just okay. But then, of course, by the time that they got here, President Carter never classified them as refugees. So pretty much all of them went to what they called reception centers. Also sounds very familiar.
Yes.
And they were oversaw for long-term detentions as basically as criminals who were considered unsuitable for release.
Yeah. I'm not a legal expert at all.
Oh yeah, and I just wanted to mention I'm not a legal expert, nor am I a historian. I am just did a lot of research for this episode, and
their only crime was seeking asylum.
Yes,
and they were detained.
Mm-hmm.
They were detained without a lawyer,
mm-hmm.
without representation, and without knowing exactly what crime they actually mm-hmm. committed. So those detention centers were just pretty much a holding tank, a mm-hmm. housing to try to figure out what to do with the refugees that arrived in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. And then in the 90s, the Haitian refugees that came, and the like you mentioned, the Jamaican-Haitian wars,
Yeah, it was a wave of different of refugees that were just hitting the U.S. shores. It went from a long line.
Yeah.
But the more familiar for me was the Cubans, Haitians, mm-hmm. and later on it was a large amount of Jamaicans that mm-hmm. were coming into the country, and you noticeably mm-hmm. you could see the whole culture of the country changing in a direction, but it still in all it was that whole understanding of how do we welcome mm-hmm. people into the country, how yeah. do we show them how to represent themselves in the country mm-hmm. and to seek asylum properly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's definitely something that I don't, you know, I'm not a UN, I don't work for the UN or anything, but I just always wonder about the next step of once you, let's say, you know, the Ms. Bell mentioned earlier that there was a family and they found asylum, they seeked asylum and they found and they lived in Virginia. It's like that whole culture shift, you know, learning from the language to the fashion to the social faux pas to like everything. It's like you are kind of at the mercy of the media just of whatever, you know. It's like how it's really hard for,
just imagine a lot of people who do come to the country, they don't necessarily come here with their families,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and a lot of it are males, mm-hmm. and males pretty much are they're not brave enough, but you know, they go and be like, okay, I'm gonna go and I'm gonna check it out, or mm-hmm. they just leave and figure that they'll venture out to this country. And then you come here, you arrive after all of that struggle, and then what? You know, mm-hmm. where do you live?
Mm-hmm.
You don't have any ID. You don't have any links to what to do, you know, and if any place, you know, you're going to.
And you can't go back, you know? You can't go back.
You
just
back.
A lot of places like Muhammad mentioned earlier in Yemen when it's war stricken, or other places where just the political climate and the political and paramilitary interventions, they just destroy everything from the infrastructure to the economy and people, or physically hurting people and killing them. So of course we wouldn't be talking about immigration and American refugees on World Refugee Day if we didn't mention September 11th as well. And that's when pretty much the whole approach towards refugees and immigration and asylum seekers changed, and now we are where we are. That's when Homeland Security was established. The Immigration Naturalization Services split into like three separate organizations. We all know what's going on now. And people who are trying to become refugees in America are facing a lot of different things and stipulations in order to gain access to, you know, that type of status. So with all that being said, I know it's a little bit heavy, and I really appreciate you listening, and Mike, I always appreciate having you here.
I appreciate you. It's been an excellent time spending this evening talking about a very important subject.
Yes, and it's the World Refugee Day, and it's it correlated with African Refugee Day, and then in 2000 the UN is like, hey, you know, let's bond powers together. So that's kind of what they're doing now. So before I'm going to wrap up, and before I do that, I do want to play a little bit of a song, or actually I'm going to play the whole song. This is a great song from me to you, and we're going to be back in just a couple of minutes.
Your walls, left to dream inside your walls, left us in a wilderness. Well, I can make my paradise. Without your walls, I am alive. Nobody I in rank and file. Girl and boy and man and wife. Flesh you measure with a smile. Have and hold and hold and have. Have and hold and hold and have. Desire deny, deny desire. Have a child to justify. Images that you apply. I won't bow my head in shame. I won't bow my head in shame. I won't play the game the same. Without your laws, I am alive. Without your walls, we all survive. Without your walls, no guilt to bear. Without your love, I love to share. Without your walls, I am alive. 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 A smile, hold and hold and have. Desire, deny, deny, desire. Have the child to justify. Images that you will find. I won't bow my head in shame. I won't bow my head in shame. I won't play the game the same. Without your walls, I am alive. Without your walls, we all survive. Without your walls, no guilt to bear. Without your love, I love to share. Without your walls, I am alive. Without your walls, I am alive. Without your walls, I am alive. Without your walls, I am alive.
Crucial scientific data.
Hello, hello. My name is Tammy, and you're listening to KBOO. My program is called Popular Education, or Pop Ed for short. I like it, Pop Ed, so I'm just going to call it Pop Ed from now on. In the studio with me is Mike. Hello, Mike.
Hello, Tammy, and I thank you for inviting me to Popular Education, but just like you said, I like Pop Ed, too.
Yes, it's Pop Ed.
It's Pop Ed.
It's Pop Ed. And, tonight we're talking about the World Refugee Day, June 20th. It's the official World Refugee Day as named in 2000 by the UN. If you, the listener, enjoy this program and you want to talk, have any comments, questions, any kind of ideas for the show, or just want to collaborate or just say, hey, good job, you can email me at populareducationradio@gmail.com. I would really, really appreciate it. Just a couple of things before we wrap up for the evening. There are a lot of different ways that you can help people around you, from refugees to the houseless community to LGBTQ activists and folks. And I just want you and urge you to go and reach out. We have this little thing called the internet, and you can just pop in there and see what's going on. There are things beyond kitty pictures that you can look at. My personal thing that is local is Food Not Bombs, and you can find them on Facebook. They have a Portland chapter that is very, 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 very active, and they do a lot of direct action type of things. If you enjoyed this evening's program, you can also just Google how to help out with refugee issues. There's a lot of Portland-based organizations, nonprofits, and you can volunteer there. And if you like what you hear, you can also volunteer here at KBOO, KBOO Community Radio. Mike, how's it going?
It's going great.
It's going well.
Yeah, definitely, if you are interested in supporting Portland theater and Portland talent, you can follow me on Instagram at Urban Human Being. I do a few things around town, so if you want to check it out, and I got dog pictures, not kitty picture, cat pictures. I have dog pictures, but yeah, Urban Human Being Instagram, place you can follow me.
Yes.
Mike.
Yeah. We all love being here and really appreciate all of you tuning in. And this is a very personally, just a very important subject for me. I really love being able to be on the air. Part of the whole idea and concept behind popular education, or pop ed, as I like to call it, is just continuing the circle of education to people who otherwise could probably maybe not afford it. And it's basically aimed towards social justice, as well as teaching one another just how to survive in this crazy capitalistic mess that we call the world.
Yeah, I love sharing information with everyone. And when we talk about supporting one another, social media can be used in so many different ways. But if you use it in a negative fashion, then that's what's going to come out of it. My suggestion is find people to support, find people to uplift. You can always send someone a thank you, a like, or a hello to make a person feel good that day. Just do something positive for everyone. Make it better.
Or physically give them a high five. Yeah. That's my thing. I'm all about physical. Yes. So, like I said, my name is Tammy. You're listening to Popular Education. And here is a final tune. This one is dedicated to my mom. I love you, Mom.
tune in to KBOO on June 22nd and 23rd for our live broadcast for Good in the Hood Multicultural Festival. We'll start the broadcast from King School Park and Good in the Hood Saturday at 2 p.m. Bands include the Elliot Young Band, Hot Tea Cold, Ronnie Wright, Cool Breeze, and more. Sunday, we'll start the broadcast at noon and we'll feature Funky Fusion featuring Amanda Ryan, the Norman Sylvester Band, Soul Vaccination, and more. Again, that's Good in the Hood, a multicultural music, arts, and food festival celebrating diversity and connecting people with resources and experiences to strengthen unity.